Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Happy Wet Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Hank. Happy Tuesday to you. And today, I think the emphasis is on parent. She's a wife, mother. I guess I say that part, not parent. Although they would go in line with each other.
Grandmother, that works in there.
Grandmother works in there too. But that parenting piece, that mothering piece, is kind of the focus of today's show. And I think it's a perfect day to kind of settle in, grab a cup of tea or a cup of coffee or whatever that comfort beverage is that you enjoy at this time of day. And let's have a talk. Let's have a conversation about parenting or mothering and raising children. And, you know, I know you haven't had children, but you were raised by a mother, I would assume.
That's true. Yep.
And so when you think back on the job that your parents did raising you, can you sum it up in a sentence, that experience?
I was shocked when I grew up that how much forethought went into it. I thought these kind of things that my mom suggested we do were all kind of spontaneous. Hey, let's do this. And hey, why don't you join band? And things like that. And I found out much later that they're all carefully planned out in hopes of making me a more well-rounded person. And that's all.
So there was intentional parenting that actually went on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I said, I don't know why you suggested I join the band because I have no musical talent whatsoever. And she goes, well, I know you're shy and I know you wouldn't make friends otherwise. And that's a good social situation. I said, wow, you thought all that out ahead of time? Yeah.
Well, and I'm glad that that came through. And it's unfortunate that for most of us, you don't get to reap the benefits of parenting that you actually did well until your children are either parenting themselves or way down the, you know, line where they finally can appreciate it and turn around and say, oh, I get that. You know, the job of parenting is definitely one of delayed gratification. There is no instantaneous prize that you get. Unless you're doing it very poorly, then you get a lot of attention from all sorts of different arenas. But if you quietly do that job of parenting, the reward in that has to be very intrinsic, because if you're waiting for kudos from your children or from someone outside of your social circle or from the publisher's clearinghouse to show up with a check, you know, that's not going to come. And so the challenge I think so many of us feel as parents is you're kind of doing this work in a vacuum, you know, hoping that you're making the right choices, hoping that you're guiding in the right direction, hoping that you have, you know, done your best, and that in the end, your child will grow into an adult that enjoys their life, that feels that they had a good start. But we don't know along the way how we're doing. There may be some indications, you know, again, if we're not doing well, but how do we know if we're doing well enough? And I think now more than ever, with this age of the internet and instant information, that it's more difficult than ever to follow a path or know if we're parenting well or know how we want to parent or to even get the information that is appropriate for our situation raising children. I mean, back in the day, there was one parenting book, and it was probably Dr. Spock, if we want to go. I know there were parenting books much further back because I actually have a pretty interesting antique collection from the 1800s and early 1900s of parenting books that were usually written by male doctors. And they're fascinating. But when we look at the modern era of parenting, there was one parenting book, and it started with Spock. And then for my generation, it was Terry Brazelton. And I remember, you know, kind of shunning the Spock experience for T. Barry Brazelton. And he actually had a television show that I watched religiously when my 30-year-old was a baby. And it was so interesting, and I just ate it up. But it was just that information. And so it was kind of easy. There wasn't a lot. And then 10 years later with my next daughter, you know, then it was, you know, different information. Things started to come out in bulk. You know, we still take T. Barry Brazelton. I still used my Bradley method of birth. You know, that hadn't kind of lost favor yet by the time I had my second daughter 10 years later. But then, you know, there was a lot of conflicting information, not only on if babies should sleep on their back or their stomach or their side, but whether they should cry themselves to sleep or when to potty train, or you know where I'm going with all this. It started to magnify the parenting information. And so now for my daughter Kirsten, who has a 15-month-old, I see her swamped in information, from online mother chat groups to online advice columns and blogs from other parents, and then books and books and books. And of course, she has my old books that I passed along, you know, some that really were meaningful to me, and then articles. And it's just overwhelming. And much of it conflicts. And much of it makes us feel guilty if we don't feel like we're living up to this high standard that a lot of the modern day parenting information would lead us to believe is possible. Because ultimately, I have never met a parent who is perfect. They might exist, but I've done this work for 25 years professionally, and I've been a parent for 30 years, and I have yet to meet that perfect parent, just as I have yet to meet that perfect functioning family. Because remember, back in the 70s, there was all the talk about dysfunctional families, and that if you came from a dysfunctional family, God forbid, you needed to get away from them because they were going to drag you down. The only problem was, the little secret was, there was no functioning family that they were using as the model for this is how all families should be. All we knew was that almost every family we all came from in some way was messing us up. And so it became kind of this outcry that this is a family model that needs to be thrown out. We're not really sure what to fill it in with, but no one should raise a family the way it was done in the 70s. So here we are in 2017, and we threw out the baby with the bathwater in the 70s, and with the high divorce rate of the 80s, changed the complete structure of families. And now we're saying, don't parent the way we used to, do it perfectly, and we're not really sure how. And so if there's ever been a setup for a sense of failure for parents, I would think it would be parenting today, because there is no one model, but there's a lot of information that's pulling parents in that direction. And no one has the corner on the market of how to do it correctly. And so today, I have invited a friend and a guest, a professional friend, into the studio to have a conversation with me about parenting and where we are in 2017. We both specialize in parenting as professionals. We've both parented as citizens. And we both continue to work with families today and have seen great changes in the stress level that parents are experiencing in the last 20 or so years. And so my guest today is Michelle Gordon. Hello, Michelle.
Hi, Elizabeth.
So why don't you tell everyone a little bit about your training experience before we jump into the topic?
Okay, so just briefly about myself, I actually started in the field of early childhood education as a preschool teacher. So spent many years teaching preschool before I had my own children, and that was quite an awakening that my beliefs about parenting and what parents needed to do or shouldn't do were sort of shattered when I had my own children, and the challenges were quite different than I ever imagined, and the tasks more daunting than I imagined. My interest in parenting grew over the years of teaching child development and early childhood studies. I currently teach a parenting class for Cuesta College, and I am with Parent Connection of San Luis Obispo County as a parent coach. So I meet with parents weekly and have conversations about their experiences, their challenges, and we sort of try to make sense of all the information and integrate that information into their own lives.
And there is such an overwhelm of information. And, of course, both of us spend a lot of time reading whatever articles come out. And just in this last week alone, just in the last 5 days and in thinking about this conversation, one, I watched a huge number of Pregnant at 16 episodes on MTV because I wanted to kind of tap in to what was happening there. It's a station I had a hard time finding. It's been so long. But if you've never watched Pregnant at 16, that's some great parenting information right there. So I watched some of that. And then I read an article about how to land your kids in therapy. And it talked about the use, you know, this goal of happiness as really being a poor model of parenting success. And then an article about medications in children, and again, how we've jumped in too early and pathologized childhood behavior, when really what we're probably seeing is normal reactions to a very stressful experience for families today. And then I read another article about attachment parenting and how, you know, there's a lot of brain science and neurological evidence behind the need for more attachment between parents and children. And then articles about the helicopter parenting world, that's kind of the generation you and I raised children in, about that over-involved parent, and how that kind of bubble wrapping of our children has caused them to be less resilient and less capable and more prone to frustration and sadness and sense of overwhelm. So I'm sitting here today finding it hard to catch my breath because I'm not even sure which direction to go with all of the information I've just read in the last 5 days. So I imagine how it must be for my daughter at 30, who is constantly, you know, researching and reading and trying to find out information, or, you know, friends of ours who have children that are still coming through high school and making college decisions, and then friends that have adult children who have varying degrees of success in their relationships with their adult children, and how that experience of raising them as children translated into a relationship for them as parents and child, and now parent and adult child. And what do we do with those relationships that struggle because whatever that parenting experience was, it didn't go as parents hoped. And so in thinking about how to kind of bring all this information together to synthesize it, what I'd like to focus on today is this idea of what does it take to be a good enough parent? D.W. Winnicott, who is a psychiatrist and English revolutionary in the field of childhood in the 1950s and 1960s, he was already addressing this idea that there was too much pressure on mothers specifically to try to do everything perfectly well. And in that effort to do everything perfectly well, it was actually causing stress on the children because the children were seen as the product of the mother's good mothering. So if your child was perfect, then you were the perfect mother. And if your child misbehaved, then you were deemed the poor mother. And so D.W. Winnicott said, we really need to focus much more on what it is to be a good enough mother. What are those things that we need to offer our child so that they have a good enough launching? And then the rest, they kind of figure it out as they go. So the question I'm putting out for you today is, how do you define your success as a parent? Not success for your child, because we'll talk about that looking at our work as a parent based on if our children are successful is, again, how we get in trouble. But let's flip it today and let's think about, how is it that we define success as a parent? How will I feel that I was successful as a parent at the end of my day, at the end of my days raising children? How would I know that I did a good enough job? What will have happened in my life, in my child's life, in my marital life, you know, in my community life? How would that success as a parent look like in all of those aspects of my life? And if we can get a definition of what parenting success would look like, if we can come up with a definition, if you can each come up with a definition for how you would define success as a parent, then we can back up to the beginning and have a better idea of how it is we need to parent to get to that place. So for parents of young children, this is a great exercise to think about, when my child is in their 20s and 30s, how will I define my success as a parent? How will I know I did a good enough job? What will be happening in their life and my life to define that? And once you can come up with some examples, then we can go back and talk about what kind of parenting needs to happen to get to this place. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of the conversation today. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest today is Michelle Gordon. We're talking about parenting, and parenting from every age, from newborn to adult children, and for parents, how do we define success as a parent? How do we know if we've been a good enough parent? You can find out more about the show on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. We post information about the show each week. You can also find out information at kcbx.org under the News Talk tab. You can listen to previous shows, and you can podcast shows by visiting iTunes or how you download your podcasts and subscribe to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And as always, you can get a hold of me by email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. And before we jump into this conversation about the parenting piece, I want to add a little bit about my New Year's pledge that I talked about a couple weeks ago, that for this year I was going to spend 5 minutes per day, five times a week, doing something that would help me to be a better person, whether it was making phone calls to the president or writing a letter on the behalf of someone or actually having a conversation with someone uninterrupted or being a little kinder or doing plank for 5 minutes or meditating, whatever it was, 5 minutes a day, five times a week. So I came home after doing the show the first week, and on my front step was a little jar of pennies and a little sign that said, Elizabeth, 5 minutes a day, five times a week. And so one of my friends took the time to count out 265 pennies, which is apparently how many times I would be doing my 5 minutes a day for the year, so that I could keep track of my success. And I just want to thank my wonderful friends for supporting my pledge and also now holding me accountable to my pledge of keeping up. And so my 5 minutes a day in the last week really has been spending more time making those phone calls about things that I care about, making phone calls about the Water is Life Standing Rock protests and about the Women's March coming up. So I just want to throw that out there. A thank you to my fellow parenting friends. And it has been my greatest source of support all the years I've been raising children is this small group of people that we met 20 years ago who we've kind of raised our families together, and we hold each other accountable, and we also support each other and give each other a lot of grace. And I think for all parents, the best insurance, but not insurance policy, but the best tool you can have for surviving the years of parenting is to have a small group of nurturing friends who parent in a similar way that you do, so that you can support each other and throw ideas back to each other, back and forth, and kind of offer support in times that you need that. 805-781-3875. Lori, why don't you kick us off today? What's on your mind?
Hi. I had a very difficult childhood with my parents and didn't have the most spectacular of fathers. And for me, it wasn't until I was an adult that I was able to look back and realize how much he was struggling. So my children are 12 and 14, and I just let them know how much it's challenging, and I'm very honest that I'll make mistakes parenting them. And, you know, I apologize to them and just ask that they look upon me with kindness as I try and manage these waters that don't come with any instructions. Mm. And I think that also gives them the freedom to make mistakes in their lives and learn from those.
Beautiful. I really like what you share about modeling for your children, that it's okay to make mistakes. And I know Elizabeth talks a lot about thinking about or envisioning in the future the kind of life skills or positive qualities that we wish for our children. And I think you're doing exactly that. A successful adult is willing to take risks, and with risks come mistakes, and then to own the situation when others are hurt or their reaction is less than appropriate. And so I think modeling that for your children and then processing it with them in the way that you are is setting them up for success. So nice.
And also, Lori, another big piece of that is that you were able to look back on your own experience being parented and give grace to your parents, to your father, because that healing piece, I think, is the only way that you were able to get set up to parent differently. And I think that's one of the things that is such a challenge for parents, is that if we can't look upon our own experience being parented and give our parents some sort of grace for doing the best they could given the information or skills that they had, you know, because I've never met a parent that intentionally tried to hurt or wound their child, right? Every parent goes into it with the highest hopes that they will do the best by their child and have differing levels of success. And so we as adults need to look back on our own experience being parented and try to find some grace or forgiveness or understanding as to how our parents made the choices they did. And once we can give them grace, it frees us to parent in a more intentional and positive way and not just try to make up for the mistakes we perceived in our own childhood.
Yeah, I agree.
Thank you so much for taking time to call. And it's interesting going back to my experience watching MTV Pregnant and 16, which is one of the common themes of almost every family was that the parents of the 16-year-old that was pregnant said, well, my parent was so strict with me, I just wanted to be my child's friend. And in almost universally every show that was the theme. And you would think at some point someone would say, maybe this idea that I'm just trying to be my child's friend because my parents were too strict is setting the next generation up for trouble. And so I pose this idea, Michelle, that how do we define success as a parent? How can we define our work as parents in a way that at the end of the day we were good enough parents or good enough mothers. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I certainly think we can set ourselves up for the possibility of success. I mean, there are never, nothing is a guarantee. But when I work with families, there are certain elements that I always try to introduce and to help them to weave into their lives. And so you bring up the idea of limit setting. Mm-hmm. And that children thrive when their environment is predictable, when there's routine, when there are both kind but firm limits. So I think we do really have to hold on to that piece, that there are a variety of parenting styles, and certainly there's room for our own unique way of parenting. But we need to keep in mind that children do well for the most part when there's routine, when there's predictability, when there's limits. And the other thing that really I think is important to keep in mind, and I'm thinking about your 5 minutes a day, and I think the last caller and talking about sort of needing to apologize sometimes to her children when perhaps she overreacts, and that's the self-care piece. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important on many levels. It's important because we need to model for our children that we also have needs, that our needs are as important as, you know, a family member, that the world doesn't revolve around our children, that everyone in the family has both rights and responsibilities. And I think we're less reactive as parents. And that's a big piece that I'm seeing really missing in today's parenting is we're bending over backwards to accommodate our children's needs, to make sure that they are the most self-actualized they could possibly be, and we're forgetting ourselves in the mix, and we're truly doing our children, I think, a disservice in doing that.
Well, and I think to stay with the term modeling, mm-hmm. right, and I think Lori brought that up, to model the ability to say, you know, I'm sorry, or to, you know, realize when we've overstepped. And again, there's always that fine line because we don't want to apologize to our children daily for parenting them, because I've also seen parents do the same thing where they apologize for disciplining their children when the discipline was necessary or the limit setting was necessary. That in ways, one of the things we have to let go of as parents is this idea that you're doing well if you're popular, you know, and that's really not a good indication of good parenting. That if you're popular with your children, your children's friends, that in some way is a cautionary moment. That if I'm on the popular end, then I'm probably not setting the limits that are needed. That I'm not saying no as needed. I'm not allowing my child to fail or come up short or take responsibility for their actions as needed. And I think it's because good enough parenting is the ability to ride that line between negligent parenting and overparenting. We tend to go generation to generation, right? One generation says, let kids be kids and do what they want. You know, our parents' motto was just don't die or get arrested and be home for dinner. So our generation, as a response, said, oh, we're going to parent much more involved than our parents did. And so we went too far. And so we do this constant swing way out. But I don't know of a time that we've really found that middle, that good enough middle where we know the difference between holding children accountable and just letting them, you know, fly in the wind. Or we know the difference between, you know, encouraging our children and taking over and being too vested. Or finding that place where we know the difference between helping our children develop skills of resilience and never allowing them to ever fail. You know, I don't know if we've found that place. I haven't read that book. I haven't read that article. I haven't seen that in action as kind of a universal professional direction. And yet, when we peel away all the noise of parenting, what you're talking about are some simple parenting guidelines that really do set up all children to do well and all parents to be able to look back and say, I did my best. And so you start with limits, as you mentioned. But what are some of the other things, those basic skills, you know, that have nothing to do with fancy fad-like parenting models or, you know, things that are regressive? But what are those kind of tried and true things that parents need to do to be able to turn around and say, I did well enough? Besides limits, what else?
So the limits, the self-care, because I think when we have the self-care, we're managing our reactions and we have the capacity to parent well. So I think that's a critical piece.
And so wait, let me jump in because let's go fine line here. What's the difference between self-care and sending my kids, you know, to daycare and activities and camps all summer long so that I can hang out at the spa? Like where is that middle ground? When you say self-care, how much are we talking?
Right. And sometimes self-care is just doing less. Mm. And so I've had a fair number of calls this year from parents of three-year-olds. And I've been trying to figure that out. What's up with three-year-olds these days? And I think what it is that we understand twos, the terrible twos, and we have that patience for twos perhaps. But we get to three and we're sort of like, my life is really busy and I'm done. And you still have a whole lot of needs. So sometimes self-care is doing less. Many times it's doing less. Asking less of ourselves, having a less hectic schedule, simplifying things, decluttering our house. So self-care different than self-indulgence or different than...
Because again, one person's self-care is another person's, you know, week away from home.
So right.
In that daily world, you know, even 5 minutes per day. Remember, there was a book when our kids were little, 5 minutes piece. And it was about a mother's quest, a mother elephant's quest, just to get 5 minutes alone. You know, couldn't go to the bathroom, couldn't take a bath. And I think just that 5 minutes, if that's the theme, 5 minutes five times a week can make a huge difference of just quieting down the noise and taking a few breaths and modeling, as you said, that ability to calm down because our children are watching us every day. So if you want to really ensure that your child will grow into adulthood the most balanced they can be, model that balanced life. Model the life you hope your child leads. And so if you're wondering, how do I best parent? The best way you can parent is to create a lifestyle that you would be happy to see your child living when they're your age. Because that's the greatest predictor of the choices they're going to make, is watching what you do as an adult.
Absolutely. And I think then the other element, the other really central element, would be skill building. Mm-hmm. So rather than seeing that our responsibility as a parent is to create this ideal happy childhood, our responsibility as a parent is to create a foundation that will carry our children into adulthood and help them to create the life that they envision. So in terms of, I think, self-care, that's a skill that they need to have to do well in the world. Resiliency, problem solving, initiative, and these all can be woven into the ways we parent. So when we choose a discipline strategy or when we choose a response to a situation, we either stop the behavior for the moment. I mean, often we just focus on stopping the behavior for the moment and we miss out on the opportunity to support the development of a skill over time.
Well, I think the word discipline makes a lot of parents cringe because they hear discipline and they think it's punishment. And really, discipline by definition means to guide or to mentor or to teach. And so when we talk about disciplining children, if we really put in our mind the idea is every time our child misbehaves, it's not that they're trying to make us insane, although it feels like it, right? Our children do not misbehave just to make us crazy. Our children misbehave because they're unformed. They lack the knowledge of other ways to behave in that situation. And so to see discipline as a teaching moment instead of a punishing moment, even though it might mean taking away a toy or taking away a privilege or taking away, you know, leaving a situation because their behavior isn't okay. But to look at discipline as the stepping stones towards how you want this child to behave when they're 5, 10, 15, and 20, that disciplining a 5-year-old who's throwing sand or biting their sister or acting out in a restaurant is not just disciplining and teaching them how to behave when they're 5. You're setting them up to know how to behave when they're 5 and 10 and 15. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You're listening to Public Radio, KCBX. We get together every week and talk about those things that we either struggle with in our life or that we engage in to enhance our lives or things that we do to support our mental health and well-being. And today my guest is Michelle Gordon. She's a parent coach and an educator. And we're talking about the role of parenting. And then in a world that is filled with too much information and too much distraction, how can we become good enough parents? Good enough so that our children have the tools they need to create a life that they'll thrive in. And I pose this idea of how do we define then good enough? What is it that we need to do? How do we stay engaged but not over-involved? How do we offer support but not take over? How will we define at the end of the day that we did our job as a parent? You know, because as Hank said at the top of the show, he looked back and realized that his mom had actually thought about the reasons that she said the things she did. And I think a lot of children would be surprised how much we as parents lay in bed at night and think about and talk about, you know, how to talk to our children or how to support them or how to encourage them without you know, messing them up. But I think today we found ourselves in a place where we're so overly concerned about messing up because we feel like the stakes are so high that, you know, anything we do that impedes our child's development as toddlers is going to translate into not getting into an Ivy League school. And so I think in order to kind of bring down the intensity and anxiety that goes along with parenting, let's take a moment to really think about what are those things I need to do as a parent that will help set my child up for a life well-lived. And so the next thing we have to define is how will we define success for our children? Is it getting into an Ivy League school? Is it having the most high-paying job? Is it, you know, having every material item they want? Because if those who think consciously about what it is you're pushing your child to do when you have them in every activity or, you know, take them on every vacation or expose them to every extracurricular activity or push them to take every advanced class, if you are pushing all of those things, then what is it you're pushing them towards? Is it that Ivy League education? Is it that, you know, big job? And what are the costs that come with pushing your children to those things, especially if those goals you have for them are not in their temperament? And so I think part of the work of parents is to understand the temperament of their children, understand their abilities as parents, and to understand what it is we actually are hoping for our children at the end of the day. And if what we're hoping for our children is good mental health and a strong sense of who they are, and then the rest will fall into place, that's a very different parenting goal than the parenting goals that are most popular today. 805-781-3875. How do you define your success as a parent? What are you looking for in raising your children? What kind of thought has gone into the choices you've made for your children? Or are you struggling and like to have a little help? Because that's the other thing, is that finding that mentor group of parents that have a like-minded idea of parenting is really essential in helping us in this idea of it takes a village to raise a child. 805-781-3875. So, Michelle, for you, you know, how did you define your role as a parent? Because you said you worked as a preschool teacher before you had children, and then you had children that changed. What is it that really changed for you in in theory and in action?
I think what was sort of most shocking at first and sort of humbled me was how challenging it was to take some of the practices, being consistent with children, following through on a limit perhaps you pose or a consequence, the difficulty of following through, and consistency. I remember as a preschool thinking, if these parents would just be consistent with their children, we wouldn't be seeing this problem. And then I got a big wake up on that one. So,
But let's stick with that because you know, we talked about limits as being a real primary parenting skill that we as parents really need to understand. What is it to set limits? What are appropriate limits at appropriate ages? That's fundamental. If you can set appropriate limits with your child and they know that every time they cross that line, you're going to step in and there's going to be a consequence, that's going to give your child a greater sense of security. We talk about attachment parenting. That's a real buzzword right now. Well, if you want to really be successful in attachment parenting, be attached to setting limits and being consistent and following through, because that is the surest way you translate to your child that I love you, I care for you enough to tell you no when it's not appropriate and yes when it's okay. That's the essence of attachment parenting, is being grounded in your relationship so your child knows every day that you are going to behave in a way that's consistent, that they can count on, and that they know that if they behave in a certain way, they're going to get the same response from you. I mean, that's solid parenting. But aside from limits, let's talk about consistency and this idea of, I used to call myself the pit crew in my family, that my job as a parent was the pit crew, that I was in my jumpsuit waiting in the pits all day long for anyone in the family to come zooming in and need a tire change or to fill up a fuel of some kind, and then I set them back out in the world. And being a pit crew can be kind of a lonely job, kind of waiting around, but I really saw that my children and my husband knew every day that this consistent kind of person was there for them and setting up kind of that grounding. So talk about consistency and really what that looks like for children.
Right. And I love that pit crew, that visual that I get with that. And I think that is so imperative, that it was very important for me as a mother to be reliable for my children and for them to know that I would be available to them, that I was both emotionally present with them, but I would be physically present as well. And I think I think it's really spending time clarifying what are your values, what's important to you as a parent. We often read these parenting books or parenting articles or have parenting conversations with a whole lot of information. We don't take the time to integrate that information, to say, this was a book about parenting values. What are my values? What are my partner's values? What is important that we share with our children in this home? Screen use was very important to me and my parenting, and my husband shared that as well. And so when we had a conversation about how we wanted screens used in our home, what limits would be set about that, and they were based on values, those limits were easy to then follow through with. Easy in that we believed in them. So I think our limits have to come from beliefs. Mm-hmm. And we have to spend some time thinking about what are our beliefs. Is healthy eating important? Am I someone who believes that we are what we eat? And if so, then what kind of limits come out of that belief? Mm-hmm. And so I think they really have to come from a place of understanding our limits, rather than it has to be thoughtful. So what are our beliefs about food and what children, what is healthy eating? What are our beliefs about screen use? What are our beliefs about routine and bedtime and how we spend time as a family? What about cell phone use during dinner time or television use? All of these are conversations that we have with our parenting support group and our parenting partner in terms of what are our beliefs and then what does that look like in practice.
And I think the challenge is once you create those sense of values, because I talk to also to parents and to our friends often about what are your values that you want to pass along to your children, what is it you want them to leave your house with? What is the identity you want your child to leave this family with? When they're out in the world and they think about where they come from, you want your child to have a strong sense of family identity. Here are the things we believe in as a family. Because children who have a strong sense of what their family believes in are much less apt to get lost or feel overwhelmed or disoriented once they go to college or out in the work world or off on their own. You know, children who have a strong sense of family values really are settled. They have a strong sense of resilience. They can get into trouble and find their way out. They can get into situations that might be, you know, uncertain, but know where they come from. So as you said, you know, right at the beginning or any time along in our world as parents, it's never too late to really sit with your parenting partner and to think about, you know, what is it we value? What is the identity we want our family to have? And then to live those values. And the challenge is when you start living those values, if the rest of the community doesn't have the same values, will you have the strength of character to stand by those values and not get wishy-washy or get swept away or get caught up in wanting to be your child's friend? Because I think that's where we get into trouble, is that parents try to be liked or flow with the tide or do what the whole group is doing or, you know, whatever popular culture is doing, but that's not really rooted in anything solid or real. And so to have something that you truly believe in, a core, a totem, a base that your family grows from, that gives your kids a strong sense of who they are, and the rest of it will take care of itself. 805-781-3875. We're talking about parenting and how we define our success as parents, or what is it we want for our children and how do we get them there? Bruce, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, we've had three children now, and what we've noticed is they're all different. So the thing is one punishment might work for one child that might not work for the other one. So our oldest child was very social. He wanted to go to all the birthday parties. He wanted to do what everyone else was doing. Our second child, he wanted to be homeschooled. He didn't want to go to school. He wanted to be homeschooled. He didn't want to go to parties. He had, I guess you would say, social anxiety. So what happened with him, we'd notice, is there would be a birthday party. Everyone was going, and he would start misbehaving right before the party. On Thursday, he would start misbehaving. By Saturday, he would be in trouble. And to him, getting his way was not having to go to the party. So my wife would say, he's going to the party. And I would say, no, he's not. And she'd say, yes, he's going to the party. You know, he doesn't want to go to the party. So we would have to find a different punishment for him. Because taking away the party was him getting his way. Mm-hmm. And it was just really interesting as far as different. You know, every kid is different. Mm-hmm. So, you know, kids are smart at a very young age. And they figure out, you know, how what they want and what, him self-destructing was not the best thing for him. Him missing that party wasn't the best thing for him. We had to make him face that challenge of going to that party and socializing with the other kids, which is not what he wanted to do, and then make him do yard work, make him do something else for his punishment rather than, you know, taking away the party.
Thanks so much, Bruce. I'm glad that you brought up temperament, because I think part of being a successful parent is to recognize your child's unique temperament and then to support your child in learning to manage their more challenging temperament traits and to sort of work with them to enhance those traits that can be strengthened and perhaps inhibit those traits that are more problematic. So absolutely, a good part of any sort of successful plan in parenting is to recognize those traits. Thanks.
Well, and also I want to give Bruce and his wife kudos, because they had a difference of opinion of what needed to happen, and they kind of came to a consensus together as a family, as a couple, and then applied the consequences together as a unified front. Because again, that consistency, if your children know that you have limits or there are rules or there are expectations, and if you don't meet them, there will be consequences. And every time there are consequences, you are saying to your child, I love you enough to hold the line. You may not like it. You may not disagree with it, but this is our family story. And I think for a lot of families, and I hear this often from my students, that my parents both parented so differently that if I went to one parent, I could get my way and the other one would fold. And so getting parents on that same page is really critical. 805-781-3875. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes. I wanted to say, you know, great show today. Thank you so much. I just wanted to add to the idea that a family is made up of more than just the children, that parents also have needs, that parents also have roles, that parents also have things that they want to do. And so I think that the idea that we would build you know, our families solely revolving around our children, I think creates a navel-gazing for our kids. And I think that it's really important that kids understand that sometimes we do do what they want to do, but we also do what mom needs or wants to do, what dad wants to do, what someone else needs or wants to do. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a little bit of a pushback on the pit crew, perhaps, but I really appreciate that metaphor, but just wanted to add that, you know, it's not just about the kids. We can be supportive while also supporting them to see that it's not only about themselves. Thank you.
Well, and Sarah, thank you. And it's interesting. I'm glad you let me clarify that, because I never saw my role as a pit crew as being there solely to cater to or meet my children's needs. It was much more of how do we keep this family running so that everyone, you know, gets what they need as best we can make it happen. And my job was, you know, running the family. So that's kind of where I saw my main work. But it was definitely never my intention to meet my child's every need, because I'm of much more of the old school parent where I grew up in a family that said, I don't care if you're happy. Happy could be a byproduct of something good that happens, but I'm much more concerned about you growing up to be a good citizen. And that's why I love to have Michelle with me, because she and I come from, I think, a little more rigid old school parenting, and she has a little more of the more modern parenting in her. And I think it's a good balance. So, Sarah, I appreciate you giving me a chance to clarify and also saying, yes, there is a huge difference between a child-centered family and a family-centered family, right? I mean,
yes. And I like that family-centered family, that we need to, you know, wrapping back to those values. And so to be really transparent in family values and to articulate to our children, in this family, everyone has the opportunity to do things they love. Mm-hmm. Everyone has the opportunity, you know, everyone's needs will be addressed, and that sometimes it'll be mom's turn and sometimes it will be your turn. So I think that's how we send our children out in the world, to be good roommates, mm-hmm. to be good partners, to be good friends. And that's our responsibility as a parent. That is how we're a successful parent, that we live those skills that we wish for our children.
So let's talk a little bit about distracted parenting, because a lot of research is coming out consistently about not just screen time and our children being in front of screens. We've talked about that, but really this idea of distracted parenting, where parents feel like they're putting in more time than ever. You know, they're in at all of their children's events, and they're always in participating at school, and, you know, they're involved in every choice their child makes. And so it looks like on the surface they're helicoptering parenting and, you know, doing everything that the perfect parent would do. But what's not being recognized is that they're also on their smartphone or on their device or on their screen 24/7. You know, so they're with their children physically, but they're not really connected emotionally or there fully. That this distracted parenting in some ways is leading to children's misbehavior. And so I read this article I thought was fascinating. Hear me out. That this idea that, you know, we pathologize a lot of kids' behavior. There's a lot of parents that believe that they're raising children that have, you know, severe disorders, you know, oppositional defiant or conduct disorder or bipolar disorder or, you know, severe acting out from very young ages of 2 or 3 years old, and taking them in to get evaluations from psychologists that are completely unnecessary. And this article suggested that part of the reason we might be seeing what we think is an escalation in childhood behaviors is that parents are so distracted by their social media or their phone or doing emails at home or, you know, whatever they're doing on their screen all the time, that their child might have been trying to get their attention in kind of normal ways for a while, maybe trying to yank on their shirt or say, mom, 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 or come look at me or see what I'm doing, or the things that kids normally do to get parents to pay attention. And when that fails, they up their ante, right? They up their activity to get their parents' behavior. So they'll, you know, poke at their brother or sister and make them cry or knock something over to get your attention. And they'll keep upping their behavior until the parent actually stops and notices. And that might be, you know, pulling out a knife and running across the room and saying, I'm going to stab you with it. That would sound horrifying to anyone. But if this child has been trying to get your attention for hours and hours or days and days, and they continue to fail and feel frustrated, it may kick off some extreme behaviors in that child. And so I don't know if we're paying enough attention to how distracted we are as parents in ways that we don't recognize, because we think we have all our bases covered because we're showing up at events or signing our kids up for things, or, you know, in person we're there but still distracted. Does that sound too wild? Is that too crazy?
You know, I was thinking, as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, negative attention is better than no attention at all. I mean, Yes. We're very familiar with that, and I think most of us believe that to be true. Like anyone else, young children, one of their basic needs is attention, and they ask for it in a variety of ways, sometimes in positive ways, and when that doesn't play out in a way that they feel felt and heard, then they'll go to different strategies,
right? Jump on their brother or sister. Exactly. Yeah.
I love that Daniel Siegel says children need to feel safe, seen, soothed, and secure. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we mean. I think that's, you know, when you're talking about distracted parenting, it's to really pay attention. Everything has to slow down. There has to be time. It doesn't happen quickly. It doesn't happen in passing.
And it's that soothing part, that just being with your children with no agenda, no activity planned. It doesn't have to be a teaching moment. It doesn't have to be playing a game. It doesn't have to be reading a book. You know, we feel like as parents, everything has to be a teaching moment or some meaningful moment every second of the day. I remember, you know, in the early 80s when I was parenting, this whole idea of quality time, that didn't matter how much time you spent with your children. It was the quantity versus quality time, you know, that you could work all day and be home for 10 minutes as long as you got the perfect 10 minutes. But that really wasn't true. It was a lie that was told that kids actually do need a quantity of time, that, you know, we've created a society that doesn't allow parents a lot of quantity of time, but that doesn't change what children need to thrive. And as painful as that is to hear for so many people, you know, if you don't have the quantity of time to just slow down and be quiet and be there so your child can just slow down themselves and be there and feel secure and feel the connection with you, listen to your heartbeat, then you're missing important opportunities for that sense of security and attachment. Because again, attachment parenting is about a child having that constant sense that I am loved and I am nurtured and there are no more expectations for me other than doing the best I can and, you know, living within this family group. So that's the part I think that makes my heart hurt, is that I feel like we've set up a culture that has now impossible standards for meeting what children need to just be okay. So how will we as parents be good enough parents in a time-crunched culture? Are we capable of putting away our distractions as parents long enough to really engage and look at our children and not having to have a manic experience of we have to do something meaningful, but just kind of lay there on the floor with them and let them kind of crawl around or talk to you or be there when they get out of school so they can tell you their story about their day. You know, children can't be they won't give you their story when you say, here's my 10 minutes I have for you every day. Children's stories about what's going on happen when they feel like talking. And it's usually, you know, when they first get out of school or when they first wake up in the morning or when they're getting ready for bed, or maybe it's right after, you know, an event. And so although I know a lot of people don't like the idea of the parent is always, you know, available because we're busy with work. But if you miss those opportunities when your children need to talk to you or are ready to talk to you, you rarely get them back. And so then we try to compensate by overdoing in all of these other ways, as, you know, activities and trips and outings and extracurricular that unintentionally actually stress our children out, because they feel like if they're not constantly doing or moving or being or achieving, they're somehow failing. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is Michelle Gordon, and we've been talking about parenting and what that looks like and kind of winding around, you know, how will you define your success as a parent? What is it you want for your child when they launch from your home or move into adulthood? And when you can figure that out, when you really have a strong sense of what are the values that you want to pass on to your child, then you can back up and know how it is you want to parent. When you know what values you want to pass along, or what, when you know what kind of identity you want your child to leave the home having, how you want them to remember being a part of this family, then you'll know how it is you want to parent. And if you'd like to continue this conversation, you can join us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can find me at Elizabeth at thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org, or also podcasts at iTunes, Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And if people are interested in speaking with you, Michelle, how can they get in touch?
I have a parent coaching line, and that is 805-543-3700, or I can be reached at mgordon, G-O-R-D-O-N, at slowparents.org. And just to mention that parent coaching is at no cost. It's confidential services, and I typically meet parents in San Luis Obispo or on the coast at a coffee shop, so we have a cup of tea together and just have a conversation about parenting.
And that's the best way, right, to be able to be in a non-stressful situation, to talk about things that are important to us. And we will continue this conversation, because I think we've just scratched the surface about where parenting can be and what kind of challenges we have. And as always, I appreciate you supporting Public Radio KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist.
Strong.